I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Living in a Box with Marcus Veer on keyboards and synthesizers, Anthony Titch Critchlow on drums, and Richard Derbyshire on vocals formed in 1985 and released their first single, also titled Living in a Box, 2 years later. That track reached the top 5 in the UK and the top 40 of the Billboard charts. During my early years at MTV, their songs were played on heavy rotation. They released 2 successful albums and had a string of hit singles. But in 1990, when Derbyshire left, the band split in accordance with the contract they'd signed back in 85. In 2004, they reformed for a one-off gig with the original lineup. But this was not to be, and over a decade later, Titch and Marcus returned to the stage with a new vocalist, Kenny Thomas. This year, they're out on the road again, not with Kenny, as he had other commitments, but with Brian J. Chambers, who has sung for Pink Floyd, Beverly Knight, and who's been a backing singer for Prince, Mark Almond, and Grace Jones. The story of the band, and particularly Marcus Veer's story, is intriguing. He might call it luck, he might call it right place, right time, but in the end, it's also the story of a combination of the right talent. So Marcus Veer, Living in a Box, this is a great pleasure to talk to you because, you know, you created tracks that were very important to me in the 80s. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm going to enjoy this. I know I am. I hope you do too. We're somewhat of a similar age. I'm 3 years older, but I'm not going to quibble about it. You might, but I feel that we're of similar age. So we may have had some sort of similar experiences growing up. Now, you, I believe, grew up in Sheffield. What sort of town was it, and what sort of early years did you have in that town?
Sheffield, you know, in the 80s or late 70s and 80s when I was a teenager, was a really vibrant scene. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why we all got into music, because we were influenced by our local bands. I mean, we had so many, you know, Martin Ware with Heaven 17, and before that, Human League. You know, there was a massive local band scene with ABC and so on. And, the, you know, the list goes on. And we were hugely influenced by that. And there was a really good sort of pub scene where you could nip out to the pub and you would see any number of great bands from, you know, Clock DVA to, you know, There Must Be Russians and all these kind of really funky name bands. And became, you know, some of them became really huge, you know, international stars. And, you know, I remember seeing ABC, one of their videos on Top of the Pops, walking by a sort of Rediffusion TV rental shop in the 80s and thinking, crikey, that lad came from Sheffield, that's where I am. And it really does inspire you, you know. So that was incredible. And we had the Limit Club, of course, which was probably 300 or 400 capacity club that had most of the bands that we all know of, from Elvis Costello to The Police to George Michael when he was going out with Wham, who probably played their first ever gigs there. In fact, B-52s played what was sort of largely accoladed as their best ever gig at the Limit Club in Sheffield. And I remember being there to see that show. And, you know, it was just electric.
I want to come back to that in a little while. I'll come back to the Limit Club in a little while because I think I've jumped a bit here. What sort of music did your parents listen to, and when did your taste diverge from your parents?
My mother was a big Burt Bacharach fan, and I still am, really. I mean, there's glamorous 60s orchestral and horn arrangements and the movies that they were often attached to. Was just, you know, the glamorous side of the Living in a Box sound came from that, really, with the horns and the string arrangements, although we were moving on to synthesizers. So it's the essence of what that brought to music was definitely Burt Bacharach and Hal David songs. And she was listening to some Supremes, Motown, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was really interested in the 3-minute pop song formula that was coming out of the States in the 60s. My sort of sound diverged, I think, when I got influenced by what else was going on in the charts at the time. I was at school in 77 when punk had reached its massive apogee, and that was really exciting. It was so irreverent and anarchistic, and that was quite exciting. And I think in terms of the lyrics, which, you know, we'll probably get onto for Living in a Box, using words like that and ideas like that probably are a slightly post-punk sort of phenomena. So I got that inspiration from all that I was hearing there.
I mean, I remember being at school, and everyone at school wanted to be a pop star. They didn't want to be a copy of someone. They wanted to be an original pop star. I mean, music played, particularly, I think, for our generation, probably more than any generation, such a massive role in our lives. And yeah. Also, I was fascinated by artists. And later on, I realized they represented something that I was hoping for when I was younger. For instance, yeah. David Bowie, being the outsider, the alien, and I wanted mm-hmm. to get the hell away from my existence as a teenager, you know, with all these
exactly.
problems that I had. Was it similar for you, and who did you actually sort of hook onto musically at that point?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, this is some of, you know, arguments or discussions I have with my kids about music today, which we won't bore on. We all know the sort of churned out, radio formatted stuff that comes out today that I have difficult differentiating between, certainly musically and certainly image-wise. And it's because we don't have the individuality that we have now. I mean, it's arguable that the Ziggy Stardust or Hunky Dory for you know, Bowie, that, you know, they probably wouldn't even be able to get signed today. You know, so we were listening to a lot of music that was really individual. So there were people presenting themselves, there was the fashion they were wearing, the look they got, the videos they were making with the MTV culture. And the brand loyalty that went along with that. If you were into a band, you listened to every aspect of their record, you looked at that sleeve, you were wearing what they're wearing, or whether you were a goth, or whether you were a new romantic, and the whole Spandau thing and the Blitz Club in London was taking off at the time, which was hugely exciting to me to be able to, even though I was up in Sheffield, we all heard about it and the local scene. In a way, with the Lead Mill later and the Limit Club before it, the whole clothing and the whole thing that came from that. And, you know, obviously with Culture Club coming up, it was like, wow, you know, we've got somebody here who's, you're not quite sure gender-wise, amazing sort of influences with the reggae and ska, with pop music. And it was all these wonderful blends that were going on that people were seemed to be experimenting and coming up with the 80s music that, you know, when we're doing these sort of tours now, I just listen to that one thing that sort of threads them together, which is the 80s. You know, it's unmistakably 80s, but there is so much diversity in the sounds and the way and the formats that the people were using to write their songs and express themselves. It was incredible.
One thing, one person you mentioned is Martin Ware, who I know is a good friend of yours. Martin, of course, is, you know, one of the greats in electronic music, and what he's actually achieved throughout his life has been immense. But he mentioned to me about a sort of a youth arts centre called the Meat Whistle, I think it was called, which was in Sheffield at the time.
Right.
He used to go. And this was something that brought him in contact with other people of, you know, the same type who were interested
That's right.
in
That's
developing
right.
music. Did you have let's say, a sponsor or a mentor or someone around you who really, it might have even been a teacher, someone who sort of pushed you to be creative, or maybe even your parents?
Well, I think it was when I was learning to play piano. I mean, at school, when I was very, very young, like one of those Bon Tempi organ nasty little things, started playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and all that kind of stuff when I was very young. And then I went to school and I couldn't really play the keyboards. They made me play the piano, which was a good thing, because the learning certain, I got up to about grade five, which is not by any means genius, but it was enough to give me the basics and the technical ability to express myself. Which I think, you know, obviously from an instrumental point of view, you've got to be able to do, otherwise you remain perpetually frustrated. And I got to about grade five, and my piano teacher said to me, you're going to give this up, aren't you? And it was, because of playing all the classics. And I thought, well, this is getting a bit tedious now. So he said, look, let's forget this. Let's go and get listen to some stuff in the charts. I'll teach you about harmonics and harmony and you know, how to improvise and all this kind of stuff. And it was that moment that kept me into music, where I'd hit that T-junction where I wouldn't be talking to you today if it wasn't for him. So, yeah.
Now, you mentioned the Limit Club. I presume this came after school, and you know, had you sort of studied and had your O levels or A levels or whatever we did at that time, and and then you worked for the Limit Club, or did that come, what age were you when you actually went there?
So I did my A levels, left school at 18. I wasn't really ever going to be a university person, as my kids who are now sending to university, I was saying I went to the University of Life, and go, yeah, great excuse, Dad, for titting around in the Limit Club. But I started work at the Limit Club when I left at about 18, and handing out flyers and putting up their fly posters, anything really to get involved with what I'd found to be a complete magnet for creativity in the music scene in Sheffield in the 80s.
Did you ever get into trouble for doing that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there was like a Manchester mob and a Sheffield mob who'd be out in the middle of the night putting up those by 40 by 30 quads or whatever size they were, slapping on the, you know, the wallpaper paste, sticking on a poster and then doing a runner. And then the Manchester squad would come and stick their stuff over the top, you know, and then, we, you know, all that kind of stuff, and handing out flyers and all that kind of thing. It was great. It was really exciting because you could you could sort of feel that you're part of something. You knew what was coming up, that no one knew. And I sort of went from there really to being asked to sort of get involved in, because I was a young kid and they were slightly older, the owners of the club said, well, you know, you seem to be into the scene. What should we be putting on here? And I suddenly started getting involved with actually booking the bands at the Limit Club, which was really exciting because it gave me a relationship with all the agents in London, which I didn't know at the time, but would eventually become really useful to me with Living in a Box in terms of meeting business people. And then they bought the Lyceum Theatre, and I started working, really booking all bands at the Lyceum Theatre for a while. And then they were booking shows all over the North of England as well. They set up a separate promotions company, which I was sort of involved in quite heavily, with doing, you know, the Clash at Leeds Queen's Hall or whatever, whatever. And it was through that I met Titch and started the band.
In terms of the bands that were there, you mentioned some. I know there was, you know, U2, Kid Creole, the B-52s. I mean, there was a sort of a massive, diverse mixture of artists that, sure, I presume you had the opportunity then of seeing live. What did you glean from their, I know they were on the a lot of them were on the way up in their careers at that time. They weren't necessarily, sure, at the pinnacle. It was one of, yeah, the sort of early days. What did you glean from the performances, do you think, that has become useful in your life? And what did you understand from them by being around them?
Well, as you say, there was a huge diversity of music. So some of the sort of more sort of schizophrenic nature of a Living in a Box album. So you've got the ballads and the sort of West Coast R&B flavoured ballads in one end, and you've got the sort of more frenetic hardcore beats of Living in a Box and Generate the Wave and Gay Crashing, which has got the other side. So I think it was the diversity of artists that I was seeing that made this Living in a Box not necessarily cleanly identifiable, because it's got quite a big wide spread of influences in what we do. And so I think it was seeing the bands live. First of all, you know, seeing live music is just insane. I mean, it's insane when you're 18 or 20 years old, and it's still as magical to me today as it was then. So seeing them, being involved in the backstage, putting them on, understanding what a rider is, organising, you know, the sound and getting the crew in early, and then dealing with the public, selling tickets, promotions, you know, that gave me a very rounded idea of what it is from one end, just taking on the music and enjoying it as a punter, but also getting involved from a business aspect and what really goes into putting on a show.
But did you want to be a pop star or did you want to create music?
Yeah, instantly. I just suddenly thought, yeah, I can play the piano. And rather sort of selfishly and probably, although as it turned out, it was okay. I thought, well, I can do that. I can understand that with music, we all have some kind of, it's like magic, right? Music is, to me, is magic. Some people can be involved in the magic and create it and others can't. It's, you know, we can all do different things, right? You know, but I just sort of thought, I can do this. I can do it. I can see the way that I want what I do to get me up on that stage.
I mean, it's funny because I've been obviously, you know, in my work throughout my life, I've interviewed, you know, really many, many pop stars. And I've always had the feeling that most are incredibly regular people, but then you find people that break a little bit under pressure because there is an immense pressure on someone being in the public eye, being on stage, creating music, and also the problems that come with that, because you're not always, no one's always successful with what they create. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So
absolutely,
that can
yeah.
also be a problem. Did you...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Did you manage to talk to them about who they were, or were you sort of in a position where you could just observe?
No, I was very much a junior partner in the whole experience. Even though I was actually booking the acts, I would deal more with the tour manager than I would with the artists. The artists, even though, as you say, they were on the ascent in their careers, I was too busy just making sure that the show went well from a business point of view. But then at the end, while the band were actually on, it was that was the point where I was going, you know, I'm wearing two hats here. I'm watching what's going on. I'm hearing the music that's influenced me and partly choosing the bands because I love what they do and I wanted to be involved in their tours in Sheffield or wherever else we were promoting them. And then I was going on with my business hat and going, right, so how much money? What's the break even today? How much cash do they want? So, you know, and all sorts of craziness that would go on in the 80s, you know, dealing with artists from a sort of more of a managerial point of view, rather than me ever having time to go, so yeah, Kid Krill, tell me about the coconuts. They look like really hot babes. I mean, you know, do you, don't you? I mean, you know, it was, or Shalimar, who would come over and I was, oh yeah, Night to Remember. Love that tune, man. You know, I might get to say that. But beyond that, I didn't really get into any deep, meaningful convos.
This holiday season, the best deal in wireless can only be found at Mint Mobile. Right now, when you switch to Mint Mobile and buy any 3-month plan, you'll get another 3 months for free. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order and activate from home with eSIM, while saving tons on phone plans starting at just $15 a month. For a limited time, buy any 3-month Mint Mobile plan and get 3 more months free by going to mintmobile.com/save. That's mintmobile.com/save. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/save.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Were you already writing music at that stage?
Well, I was writing. Yes, I was, actually. It was, although it was, strangely, I was sort of more influenced at that particular time by some of the West Coast virtuoso musicians. So someone like Larry Carlton, who's a sort of jazz guitar aficionado, And we had a little band that I set up in my dad's warehouse that started off, that was just playing live, like Greg Phil and Gaines, the Crusaders, that kind of a sort of really nice sort of Rhodesy chops and beautiful guitar parts. And Titch got involved and started playing the drums. So we had a little trio, but it wasn't actually formulating 3-minute pop songs that were commercially, sensible in that way. It was more just sort of getting into the music and the skill and getting into a musical fantasy land in a way. It wasn't I say songwriting per se. It was just getting our chops going on our musical instruments. It's very instrumental based. That later came into play because like I was saying to you before, grade five on the piano doing classics is one thing. Then going into a bit of a jazzy kind of like, let's just get these musical chops going and enjoy just not writing a formatted three-minute pop song, to eventually doing exactly that. There was a process.
So when did you actually meet Titch, and what was your impression of him? I don't know if you met him at school or you met him actually sort of later because of this live venue.
Yeah, well, I met him because we were doing the Clash at Leeds Queen's Hall, and that particular tour was... they wanted local band support. And so because I was really involved in the local band scene, it was fairly easy for me to get tapes together of local bands and reach out through the Star in Sheffield or whoever else it was. I can't remember. We just said we're looking for support for this. So, of course, we were flooded by demo tapes. And one of the demo tapes was a band called Typhoon Saturday, who Titch was playing drums with at the time. I actually found out where the promotions office was and came in and said, listen to this, man, this is just going to be, you know, we'd love to do the support. At the end of the day, they didn't get the support, but I thought the drums were amazing. And in a totally selfish way, I was going, I could really do with a drummer as good as that. And I said to him, look, we can't put you on at this show, but I am putting something together. And in the meantime, he was working on the Moor, on a market stall in Sheffield. And we were at the Lyceum Theatre, and I said, do you want a gig as a, like, do you know what a follow spot is? And he said, no, what is it? He said, well, you know, when you're on stage and you follow people around with the spotlight, the CSI follow spots. So they're big, massive things in those days that, you know, got up to about 300 degrees centigrade and burn your face off. So he said, yeah, well, it's, I don't know what it was, £5 an hour, which was quite good then. So he came down and he got on the follow spots in the Lyceum Theatre for some show or other. And we started chatting and getting on, and it's like, he was like me, really into it. And we just became really good mates. And, as you do, you start talking about music and all that kind of thing. We got on so well that we started to put a little band together. And I remember Live Aid being on at the time, and as me going around to his, or him coming around to my house, and I was watching Live Aid going, Jesus, this is amazing. I mean, look at what's going on. The artists are incredible. We've got to get a piece of this. Surely we can do this. And was that 84? I'm not sure if it was, somewhere around there. Anyway, so we hit it off really well and started rehearsing, started playing. And then we did that jazz thing, which I was talking about. And then we got into a studio and started recording songs and, you know, for about a year or so. That's how we met, basically through me being in the promotions business and him being applying to be a support act.
What was the moment that you realized that what you were writing could be successful in the right combination with the right people and so on and so forth?
I think when I'd first written the backing track to Living in a Box as a backing track, actually, for, this sounds so out there, but we had a friend of ours who had a hotel chain who we'd met on holiday. Me and Titch went away to Greece, and he got a couple of Sheraton hotels in New York. And he took pity on us. I think he thought, well, here are a couple of down at heel musicians and they'll never do anything. But listen, so he said, we've got opening a new bar. Why didn't you write a jingle for this bar in the States? And we'll put it on the radio. We'll pay you for it. And so I went away and wrote what was the backing track to Living in a Box. So somewhere out there is a jingle with the backing track of Living in a Box on it. And they paid us for it. And then I started thinking, as I was listening to that backing track, Titch and I were in the studio. I took it home. I had about a week or so before this, had a conversation with a mate who said, you know what, I feel like I'm living in a box. And he was living in Hyde Park Flats in Sheffield. And I didn't think anything more. It's just something that sort of stuck in my head. And as I started to sing over that track, I thought, well, that just sits so tightly on that beat. And, you know, you just got to have that moment where the lyrics and the music cannot be separated. And you think, well, that is pretty awesome. And I remember saying to Titch, right, this is how it goes. And I sang it to him over the top. He said, you can't have cardboard in a song. I mean, what sort of shit is that? And I went, well, no, you can have cardboard in the song, because that's precisely why, because that's the one that is the earworm where people go, what? Oh, yeah, I can relate to that. You know, I understand what living in a box is about and what that means to me. And that was probably the moment when it was like, wow, I think we've really got something here. Although it wasn't really until Richard sang on it in the demo studio that it was then it was like, okay. No, not only got the melody, the song, the lyric idea, which is a bit kooky, then this dude sings on it. Wow. Now we're in business.
Were there other words that came up apart from cardboard?
No, because I was looking for that syllable that just dropped on that. And that's, I think it was sort of slightly biographical, autobiographical. You know, I was at home in just outside Sheffield in my mum's house. I hadn't really left home then. I mean, I sort of had a girlfriend in Sheffield, so I was doing going toing and froing. My mother's house was about 12 miles outside. And I was feeling, you know, like you said, you know, frustrated with my life. And I wanted to break down what I would perceive would just sort of almost was like some kind of feeble mindset that was the only thing that was stopping me getting to where I wanted to go. And that is the cardboard box, you know, that it is breaking through the cellophane line. Again, cellophane, I'd stick another weird word in there. So that's what it was all about, really. And it just sort of came, and I think I wrote the song. I mean, literally, once I'd got it, maybe an hour, I got it down. I was like, gee, I can't get it out of my head. This is awesome. And that to me was the, you know, as we went on to and record it, it became what it became.
I mean, you mentioned Richard Derbyshire. What did you know about him before that moment? Because he was in the same studio.
He was,
time,
yeah.
He came in. And that's, sorry.
Yeah, he came in after us. We were looking for other singers, and we got other people in, and I'd put a guide vocal on Living in a Box, really reeling off the quarter inch or the half inch tape, as it might have been in those days. And Richard was waiting to come in next. And we'd heard about this amazing guy, and we'd got an engineer who said, oh, there's this guy coming in, you know, I don't think there's a chance that he'd do your stuff, because he's a bit more middle of the road, a little bit more Chicago, a little bit more, you know, and he's got the most insane, he's Michael McDonald, he's a, you know, white kid, but you think he's black. And it's like, oh, wow, okay, so we met him, and here comes this blonde Elvis, amazing guitar player, walks in, and he said, Marcus, that's I love that tune, that is so on it, mate. I said, would you stick a guide vocal on it? And he said, all right, well, I've got 10 minutes. Let's see how it goes. So he stuck a vocal on it. And of course, it's just like, oh, my God, I mean, it's done. We're done. And I said to him, you know, were you up for, I don't know. I don't think I said anything at the time, because I think he was kind of crack on with the session, but I got hold of him the next day and said, this just sounds incredible. You're up for doing something together. And he said, well, I'm looking for a solo deal. And on my own, I'm not really interested in being in a band. And I said, well, we've got the song, you've got the voice. Honestly, mate. And he went, yeah, I can see what you're saying. So I said, if we can just do another couple of demos and I can go to London with Titch and we can try and get a record deal, you carry on doing what you're doing with your stuff. And if you get a record deal and you fly with your stuff, well, tough luck to us, but it's almost the first across the post. If I can get a deal with this, we didn't have a name or anything. And he said, well, if you can get a deal, I'm in.
And, did you ever think about the dangers of having three people where two of them are friends, and one of them is an outsider, I know, immensely talented and so on, but did it ever come up in your mind, could this be a dangerous sort of partnership?
Absolutely. I mean, it really did, and it turned out to be so. I mean, there was always Titch and I, and then there was Richard. I mean, listen, let's get to it. We had the most amazing time, and we still remain great friends to this day, but there was always going to be a little bit of Richard wanting to do a solo career. And do his solo thing. And he, you know, he's a songwriter in his own right. And so, yes, there was, but we just took advantage of the moment we were in, you know, to be honest. It was just like, listen, this guy is just so good. I could wait around for another couple of years and never find anyone as good as that, who was a lovely guy and is a lovely guy, you know. So, yes, there was always at the back of our mind, both Titch and I spoke about it at the time. It's like, this might not be for the long term, but let's just go with it.
Now, you mentioned before that working at the Limit Club, you got to know agents, you got to know people that were connected to these stars that were working there, and these people were in London. Were those the people then that you went to initially? Who did you go to actually get a deal? Did you go straight to record companies? Did you go to someone else?
Titch and I jumped in a car once. We'd got Living in a Box, Generate the Wave, and one other I can't remember off the first album, and jumped in a car. And in those days, it's not as easy now, but I suppose you could still do it. We arrived in London. For some reason, we came off the M1, drove through into the centre of town, stopped off in Holland Park, and there was a red phone box, which is still there to this day, and got in it and opened up the Yellow Pages and started at A for A&M, met them, can't remember what B, C for Chrysalis, and we got a record deal. We'd also talked to MCA and Virgin, and it all got a little bit crazy. They all went freaked out and went, this is a hit, we've got to sign you. And we had to get a manager who then had to hide us in a hotel because it all got quite, you know, Simon Draper and Richard Branson invited us down onto their hallowed barge in Maida Vale, and we talked to them. So it was literally, yeah, listen to us, we're here, we're Northern lads. And they, you know, they still to this day, Chris Wright would go, I remember you walking in, you know, you're about 2 foot off the ground, you knew you'd got something. And we thought, okay, we'll listen to it. You know, can you imagine trying to do that nowadays? It's all like, oh no, sorry, you've got to know the right people, and it's all a bit digital, and you know, send me some stuff, how many followers have you got? We just literally tore the doors down and went, listen to this. And yeah, everybody we played it to just loved it and got it totally.
I mean, the way that you say that is a sort of one-sided way, because there's three guys, you know, that, well, let's say, you know, you and Titch is particularly coming down from Sheffield, going to get a deal and being excited, you know, being 2 foot off the ground, being excited. Record companies weren't always full of nice people. Do you know what I mean? And I know you weren't completely green, but were you aware of the deal, and were you aware of what you were signing into and what you were sort of entering at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, we started with a publishing deal because they helped broker the final deal, and we got Chris Morrison, who managed, you know, Major and Ultravox, and had managed Thin Lizzy, and, you know, was doing, you know, did really well in terms of helping us understand what we were getting into. In retrospect, we made a mistake, possibly, with going with Chrysalis, because at the time they were absolutely a mess in the States. So we never really got to get a piece out of that pie, which was over 50% of the world market at that time. So we were recouping out of less than half of the world when that Living in a Box turned out to be a hit in every country of the world. Although it only got to number 17 in the charts in the States, and then they pulled the independent pluggers off, and then that was the end of that. So even though they were doing well with Billy Idol and Huey Lewis in the News, and they were absolutely smashing it out of the park, unless you were signed in the States by Chrysalis, if you were signed in the UK, they kind of felt like they'd inherited something that they then got to go and sell, and didn't really matter. They didn't have any personal investment in it. And that was very much, in hindsight, a mistake to sign with Chrysalis. But we were happy that we had got the record off the ground. Listen, we had a hit record, a great career with them, but it was limited in terms of what we felt we could have done in the States. I mean, remember that we're Living in a Box, when that foot record first broke in the UK, was on Tony Blackburn's Radio London show, and he had Bobby Womack in the studio at the time, and he played the 12-inch Arthur Baker mix of Living in a Box three times back to back, which he's never done before or since. And Bobby Womack decided to go off and take the record and try and put out a 7-inch version of that with MCA in the States before we got our record out. So anyway, Chrysalis ended up having to injunct that. But the process we went through with Chrysalis, we really had a great time with them, and we did very well in everywhere else. But the big bugbear with us, and part of the reason why we didn't really go beyond the second album, was because we just couldn't recoup in the States. And Richard particularly found that hard to swallow. It's like, we've given you a great record that's perfect for the States. And listen, to this day, people still in America know the song really, really well. But we didn't feel we got our just desserts there. So that was the big mistake.
How did you get to work with Richard James Burgess?
That was a sort of, you'll be working with Richard James Burgess, who, by the way, is currently in West Hollywood. And we're going, right, great. Fantastic. We're freezing our yin-yangs off in Sheffield. We're just looking at trying to buy houses or rent house flats in London. And about 2 weeks later, we're in West Hollywood. He'd done Trapped Colonel Abrams, to be less flippant about it, which we thought was a great record that sounded really mighty, like we wanted to sound. So that was the key, really. It was just like, okay, well, also he's, you know, the original idea was just to go and record a single, go and record Living in a Box, but we got on with him so well and we had such a good time, we were reluctant to come back to the rain. So I think we were, you know, quite happy to go and record with Richard.
He'd also done, you know, I mean, he was really one of the first major producers in the era of new romanticism, wasn't he? To cut along.
That's right. I mean, it's
short. I mean,
yeah, I mean, he'd started with Landscape. Track.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Sorry, I know. He's worked on some fabulous things. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, he'd worked on some fabulous things. I think we found personally that when we actually got to it, I don't know, because we've actually just found, we think, the original demo of Living in a Box, which I still haven't heard, but Titch's brother's just moving house in Derbyshire, and he said, it's in the loft. I can see it. I can't wait to hear it, because in my head, I always thought it was even better than the finished master. And I think sometimes when you, as a recording artist, if you've done a great demo and you've got all that energy, and that was the one that got you the record deal, you are emotionally attached to it, and then you've got to start again. The technology wasn't such, especially for us recording on an 8-track, that you could just put the stuff out like you can now, or tinker with it and stick it out, because you recorded it on a Mac in digital pristine land. So going over it again and recording the whole thing again was sort of, we found that quite hard work, and we're never really satisfied with the finished record. We also had some technical issues. I think the engineer was blowing a lot of coke up his nose at the time. So we ended up having to get Tom Lord Algy, who just won an award for Back in the High Life again, Steve Winwood, who just won a Grammy for that, to mix or remix it, because we had to do a lot of re-recording to get it to the point where we could put it out.
Now, you said that you went to LA, you just signed a record deal, you went to LA. Yeah, and at that point, you hadn't had a hit, obviously, because it was pre. But you'd gone to LA, and there you are. You're probably on cloud nine, I would have thought, going there, totally. Thinking, oh, God, this is amazing. What a life. What happened in LA?
Well, LA, well, listen, I don't know how far we can go on this conversation.
Go as far as you like.
Well, you know, LA in the 80s, what can you say? It was insane.
And to know what happened in Hollywood, you'll have to listen to part two, where Marcus continues his story and talks about the difficult time immediately after Living in a Box, his amazing Kids Trucks TV success, and about the new lineup of the band as they prepare to return to playing live.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.